الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين وخاتم النبيين وسيد المرسلين أبي القاسم محمد. وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين. ولعن الله الدائم على أعدائهم أجمعين من ليلتنا هذه إلى يوم الدين. السلام على الحسين وعلى علي بن الحسين وعلى أولاد الحسين وعلى أصحاب الحسين. My dear respected elders and brothers and sisters in Islam and Iman, we've gathered here for a majlis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And this is truly a blessing which we should be turning to Allah Ta'ala in gratitude. Ya Allah, you've brought me to the gathering of mourners for Abu Abdullah al-Hussein. I want to begin by first mentioning some points about the majlis of Imam Hussein, what we're here for and what it's about, and then inshallah, introduce the topic that I'd like to be covering. There was once a famous poet who lived at the time of our sixth Imam alayhi salam. His name was also Ja'far. And once our Imam alayhi salam summoned Ja'far ibn Affan al-Ta'i. He said that, "I've heard that you compose and recite poetry and you do so well. Is that true?" And Ja'far says that yes. So he tells him that, "I wished for you to compose some poetry about my grandfather Hussein alayhi salam." And when he does so, the tears begin to flow from the eyes of our Imam. And he tells him that just as we are gathered here and we are mourning and we are crying, Al-Malaikatul Muqarrabun, the near angels have also gathered and they are crying and weeping even more than we're weeping. And he tells him that whoever recites poetry and then cries or makes someone cry, فَلَهُ الْجَنَّةِ وَغَفَرَ اللَّهُ لَهُ, that person deserves Jannah and Allah Ta'ala forgives him for that. And so this is, inshallah, in accordance to the sincerity of our intention, a gathering which is attended by the divine beings. It is a gathering which in history is extremely important and pivotal. Imam Khomeini rahmatullahi alayh has said that if we want to know how is it that the rules and the ethics of Islam, the virtues of character, the makarim al-akhlaq, the deen itself, the deen which is the true deen of following Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam and the ulul amr after him, if you want to know how that has been passed on generation from generation, it's through the majalis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. He says in another one of his comments about the majlis of Imam Hussein, he says that imagine that you have a flower. That flower, in order for it to continue to bloom and continue to be preserved, it needs water. Those tears that we consistently shed for Imam Hussein alayhi salam are like the water that waters the flower, which represents the mission of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, which is the mission to preserve the deen of Islam. So we cannot underestimate, brothers and sisters, the importance of these such gatherings. We can only ask ourselves that what is it that we can do in order to perform this responsibility that we have in the best way possible. And to, inshallah, make these majalis be a source of pleasure to the grandson of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, Imam Al-Hujjah al-Jalallahu Farajuh al-Sharif, salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. What are we here for and what do we want to accomplish? There is a brilliant analysis that the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei has made regarding the incidents of Karbala. He says that we can discuss this tragedy and this event from three perspectives. Number one, we can look at the causes behind why it happened. What were the motivations? Number two, he says that we can look at the dars, meaning the lessons that we can derive from it. But he says that we shouldn't just stop there, but we should also be looking to understand what is the ibrah that we can take from it. Now, what is the difference between dars and ibrah? Typically, when our scholars use these two terms and they use them in contrast with each other, although they have a similar meaning, by dars they mean the positive inspirations and lessons we can take from something. For example, we all learn about the importance of sacrifice and the importance of ubudiyya and taqwa and love and ishq and brotherhood and performing one's duty and such positive lessons from the qiyam of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And those, inshallah, we do wish to learn from and we will, inshallah, be remembering them. But there's a third category that he mentions, which is the ibrah. Ibrah comes from the Arabic word, which is to cross over. What is the difference between the two? Ibrah is where you don't just look at the positive type of examples that you can take, but you look to understand what was it that caused such a thing to happen in the first place, and what can we do to prevent such a thing from happening again? Meaning we look at those negative qualities and those negative actions that led to this to happen in order, and we study them well. And this is a type of discussion that sometimes people do not want to have. Sometimes, unfortunately, the majalis can become a way of only focusing on the positive but forgetting about the negative. And this is a tradition which goes and dates way back. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says in a tradition regarding the Bani Umayyah, inna Bani Umayyata يُطْلَقُوا لِلنَّاسِ تَعْلِيمَ الْإِيمَانِ وَلَمْ يُطْلِقُوا تَعْلِيمَ الشِّرْكِ. Bani Umayyah were totally okay with people learning about Iman, but they did not allow people to learn about shirk. Why? لِكَيْ إِذَا حَمَلُوهُمْ عَلَيْهِ لَمْ يَعْرِفُوهُ. Because if when the beloved of their beloved, and yet some 50 years after his death, they treat him the way they do. They saw how our Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi took Imam Hussein alayhi salam, Imam Hassan, even though they were children, and he introduced them as Sayyida Shababi Ahlil Jannah. These are the youth of paradise, even though they're children at that time. They saw how much love he showed them. Even during the time after the Prophet, when anyone wanted to know who was the most virtuous, who was the most knowledgeable, who was the one who was the most courageous, who was the one who was the exemplar for all the noble virtues, whether it be in Medina or Mecca or anywhere in between, the entire ummah knew that you could not find the excellence that is found with the Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein with anybody else. But how could people turn over so quickly? How can it be the case that in the same city in which people lived in, Kufa, where they saw Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam as the hakim, as the leader, just how many years later? 20 years later? They are parading the heads of his children and grandchildren on spears in that same city. How can it be the case that an ummah can accept the likes of Yazid as their leader? These are deep questions that we have to understand. And I want to turn that question to you tonight. Have you ever thought about this? That what was the main reason why people turned against Imam Hussein alayhi salam? What was the main reason why you had scores of so-called believers and Muslims who were silent in the face of the oppression? What was it? Some of our scholars have analyzed, make a very beautiful analysis of people in society on the basis of some of the teachings of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, a type of sociology, but derived from the teachings and the pure teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. They say that we can divide people in society, whether it be at that time or this time, into three main categories with respect to how much they are committed to truth. There are one group of people who are the worst of people. They have nothing to do with the truth. All they do is pursue their lower desires. And these are people who in Nahjul Balagha, Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he actually says that perhaps we can compare animals to them. He doesn't say that we can compare them to animals. But animals are at a higher, we can compare animals to them. These are one group. Group number two are people who are just the followers, kind of like flies. They go from one place to another place, wherever they smell the rotten corpses, they go from one to the other. They don't have any type of agenda. They're just the masses. Ignorance is what distinguishes them. But then you have a third group of people who are committed to the truth. They're committed to the deen. But within this group, we can also divide them into three groups. Now, this is the minority we're talking about. This is important for us to understand. We're still talking about the minority here. The majority, you know, is kind of off. In the minority, we divide that into three groups. These are people who are all committed to the truth, but we have three groups within them. Number one, we have people who are committed in principle to the truth. They like the idea of truth. But the reality is that they are so overcome with their passions, they're so overcome with fulfilling their desires, that in reality, they don't have any action which matches that. They're too just busy pursuing their own dunya. That's group number one. Group number two are people who, they're committed to the truth, and they actually do some things for that as well too. But they only go so far as when it doesn't really involve taking a stand. Because taking a stand, especially taking a stand against the majority in the society, is something which is very difficult. These people are not ready for that type of qiyam. But then you have a third group of people, and if you've been following with me, this is the third group of the third group. The third group of people are those who are committed to the truth. And they are willing to put everything on the line for that truth. They have committed themselves completely towards this cause. Even if it involves doing a qiyam, even if it involves standing in front of the society, even if it involves sacrificing everything that they have. Now, brothers and sisters, if we look and see, who are the people who are left on the day of Ashura with Imam Hussein alayhi salam, we see that it's these type of people. The people whom Allah Ta'ala helps his deen through these people. On the other side, you had all sorts of assortments of other people. You had the people who were the pure evil ones. You had the people who were just lip service to the truth. You had the people who actually might have done some things for the truth in their life, but they weren't willing to take a stand against a society. If we want to categorize the people who were on the other side against Imam Hussein alayhi salam on that day of Ashura, the characteristics perhaps that we could say unites them all is that they were people who were worshippers of their hawa. Hawa meaning their lower desire. They were people who had strings of attachment from their hearts and passions and desires that they were not able to put aside when it came time to stand for the truth. On the other hand, if we go and look at the hearts of the believers, the true believers, the shuhada, what was in their hearts? What kind of attachment did they have in their hearts? Rather than saying it for myself, let me quote to you something from Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, if you can help me with the salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. In tradition, we are told, and can I have, for the sake of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, inshallah, to attract the special attention of the Imam of our time to this majlis, can I have a beautiful united salawat ala Muhammad wa ala him? In one incident, we are told that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam was traveling. This was before the time, of course. He was traveling through Karbala, and he stopped there with his army. And he says something to the surprise of his companions. He says that this place here is manahu rikabin wa masari'u rashaqin. He starts to describe this land as being a place where hundreds of prophets and hundreds of their grandsons have been buried. He says, this is the place which is the stopping place, the place of dissension and rest for people who are mounted. It's a place which is the killing ground of the ushaq, of the people who had ishq, people whose hearts were filled with love. So if we want to say what was the main difference between these two, we can say on one hand you had people who had love for their own passions and their desires. On the other hand, you had people whose hearts were pure of these desires. The only one who could be with Imam Hussein alayhi salam was the one whose heart was cut off from these desires. And so because of this important ibra that we get from analyzing the tragedy of Karbala, I have chosen as our topic for this series to be an examination of the idol of the self. The idol of the hawa. The idol of the nafs. Why is it called an idol? I want to mention a few brief traditions regarding idols. Idols in the history of humanity go back a very long way. Scholars who have analyzed this, they say that there are multiple traditions, perhaps all of them are true, regarding how they originated. And because we're going to be talking about the idol of self, it's important for us to at least have a background of what we're discussing and what it's how idols are related to the self. One tradition says that it was soon after the time of Nabi Adam alayhi salam that there were some pure individuals in the community, people who were known as Wud and Suwa and Yaghuth and Ya'uq and Nasr. And these were people who had an impact on people, and when they died, people were missing them. So Iblis la'natullahi alayhi went to the people and he says that, why don't you make a likeness for them, carve out some sort of picture or statue of them so you can remember them. And people used to, you know, when the weather would get cold, they would bring in the idols inside home. And then they would bring it out in summer. And when that generation passed away, the children came. They didn't understand the significance behind it. So Shaitan sort of started to tell them, well, these are objects of worship. And it took off from there. And these became some of the main idols that were worshipped in history. And one tradition says that these same original idols that were worshipped at the time of Nabi Nuh alayhi salam, they were buried in the ground with the great flood. But they resurfaced at the time of the Jahili era. And so at that time, these great idols were unearthed from the ground, and suddenly people were once again worshipping the idols of the past. Another tradition says that the idol worship began at the time of Nabi Ismail alayhi salam. Nabi Ismail and his progeny settled in Mecca, where it was the Haram of Allah. And as they started to migrate away from the Haram, they wanted some sort of keepsake. And so what they would do is they would take rocks as kind of like a memoir or a souvenir. And eventually the reason why these rocks had reverence began to be changed and thwarted by Shaitan, and people started to worship them. Or other people say that people used to, after the death of Nabi Adam alayhi salam, they used to do tawaf around his grave. And when Nabi Nuh alayhi salam put an end to this, then as a result, kind of to show that they were upset, then Shaitan introduced idols to them. So this was some of the origins of idol worship. And idols throughout time have been built through a very wide variety of materials. It can be stone, it can be wood, it can be other things. It can even be clay, it can even be food. We're told in some historical traditions that people, for example, would make cheese, and I guess certain tribes were really, you know, had a great affinity for cheese, so they would worship their cottage cheese, and this would be an idol for them. Now, what were they getting from the idols? And the reason why I'm saying this is because we want to connect the idol worship to the hawa. When we go to the Quran gives us different reasons for why people worship the idols. Allah Ta'ala in Surah Maryam, he says, اتخذوا من دون الله آلهة ليكون لهم عزة. People are seeking izzah from these idols. They are looking for some type of grandeur or some type of, you know, connection to a source of dignity for them. And so they connect through the idol itself. Or in Surah Yasin, Allah Ta'ala says, اتخذوا من دون الله آلهة لعلهم ينصرون. They take gods and idols and they worship them. Why? Because they're looking for some assistance and some success and victory. For example, they're fighting the other tribe, so they need to appeal to their idols. But perhaps we can say that if we divide people into two groups, the people are the masses and the people are the elite, and this is important because we're leading up to this connection between the two, we can say that the treatment of idols and the reason why people worship idols differs according to the level of the person. The masses go to them because they're looking for some type of power. But the elite have another ulterior agenda and motive behind why they go and worship idols. What does Allah tell us, for example? In Surah Al-Ankabut, He says, إِنَّمَا اتَّخَذْتُم مِّن دُونِ اللَّهِ أَوْثَانًا مَوَدَّةً بَيْنَكُمْ فِي الْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا. The reason why you have your idols is because it's a source of mawadda. It's something which keeps you together. It defines your identity. You know, some people, for example, they get really excited about, you know, sharing this same sports team with somebody else. They're like, okay, well, you know, we're both fans of the same football club or something. So that's a bond between us. So throughout history, the idols of a culture have been something which linked them together. And sometimes it would be a source of national pride for them. This is your idols, those are your idols right there. This is our temple's idols, and that's that temple's idols right there. If we look at it, brothers and sisters, and we examine what is an idol about, let's say that somebody who is looking at it from more sort of an intelligent perspective. Okay, why is it that they would be making idols? Number one, imagine that somebody makes an idol. What's happening is that they're making something that they themselves can break. I can make it and I can break it as well. Number two, I'm making something that cannot talk and cannot hear. So how is it throughout history that these idols were great sources of, you know, communication to the people? It was because people would speak on their behalfs. They would say that, look at what the idol is saying, or look at what this idol is doing to us. It's heard our request and this is what it's saying. Well, what happened is that they would be making idols that were material in nature and limited like themselves. And they knew that. We have in tradition that people would, for example, take a stone as an idol that was quite, you know, appealing to them, colorful, good looking. And when they would find another one, they would cast aside this stone and they would go for the next one. If we look at this, something that's limited, something that's material, something's about my making it and my choosing it and my breaking it and my getting rid of it. Something that I'm the spokesperson for. Something that I can tell a tale about. What is the conclusion that we can get if we think about this and ponder upon it? What we can realize is that idols throughout history have been a front. They've been a fraud. They've been a means of deception for what? For nothing but human beings to worship themselves. The idol isn't something which really people thought of as being what it is among the elite. They knew that this was something which they could assert their own agenda and they could exploit others the way they wanted to exploit them. In other words, the idol is all about the idol of the self. And this is something that would make Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi cry. We're told in tradition, we're told in hadith that one time there was a companion of our Prophet who comes to him and he sees something in his face that makes him unhappy, meaning the companion unhappy. So he asks the prophet, he says, that why is it that I see you in this state of mourning and crying? He's saying that I know, and to paraphrase here, I know my people. They are not going to be people who worship a sun or a moon or an idol they make with their own hands or a rock. But rather they're going to be worshiping. In this example, he says, what other people are going to be thinking about them. Meaning that what is going to matter to them is not God, right? But rather something about themselves and their own appreciation in the eyes of people. In another hadith, which is reported from Rasulullah, he says that "A'da aduwik nafsuka allati bayna janbayk," meaning that the most severe of your enemies is your very own self that is right in front of you. You don't have to look at which idol is going to be carved out next. You yourself and your attachments and your lower desires, these are the thing which is the source of your worship. So brothers and sisters, we hope to be looking at various practical manifestations of the idol of self in our society today. And if any one of us think that, you know, we're free of this type of idol worship, we need to ponder very deeply. If we look at, for example, and we see, you know, why is it that sometimes we have major problems in our families? One of the reasons is because of the idol of self. If you look and see, why is it that people have such a problem in understanding what the Islamic system of governance and leadership is and the way the communities ought to be organized, a lot of times it's the problem of the idol of self. If we want to understand why is it that sometimes we're people who are doing ibadah regularly, but this ibadah is something which doesn't take us anywhere, we don't feel any spiritual connection to it, again, we can look at the idol of the self. If we want to see why is it that sometimes our efforts to come together as mu'mineen who are committed to a cause and we're working towards that cause and sometimes we don't have the right dynamics amongst each other, again, sometimes it's the problem of the idol of self. Inshallah, if Allah gives us a tawfiq, I wish to be able to look at these different manifestations of this over the upcoming nights. The last thing I want to, inshallah, mention for tonight, we have a shorter program tonight, inshallah, we'll have more time in the upcoming programs, is that when it comes to these majalis, there are certain adab that we want to be observing. You know, our the great ulama of spirituality, they say that, for example, when it comes for salah, if you want to be able to attain some of the higher levels of salah, you have to make sure that you observe the adab of salah. You know, how is it, for example, that you take wudu while performing the dua as well too? How is it that you're supposed to place your hands when you're standing in prayer and in the ruku and the sujood? How should you sit in between the two? All these have certain adab regarding them. The same way, if we want to take the benefit of azadari and majalis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, we have to be observing those adab. Now, I don't have time to go into many of them, but I'll just mention a couple of them. Inshallah, if Allah gives us a tawfiq, we'll mention a couple of them later. One of them that Ayatollah Jawadi Amali mentions, he says that no one should enter the majalis of aza without being in wudu. It's very interesting. He doesn't say that it's good for you to do wudu or you should do wudu. He says no one should enter it without doing wudu, especially the young people. And they should do wudu with this intention that I wish to enter into the majlis of aza in a state of purity and goodness. It's very interesting to see this aza as being an act of ibadah. The second one comes from Ayatollah Khamenei, hafidhahullah. He says that when it comes to these majalis, and I'm saying these for myself, brothers and sisters, and inshallah you can benefit as well, that let's treat these majalis as ways of connecting to Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hussein alayhi salam is very much alive. He's very much aware of your and my presence right here, right now. And his sacrifice was something that was made for this religion and for the practice of it to be kept alive. This is a time for us to not just be here with our body, but with our hearts as well. Another point that's mentioned by Ayatollah Khamenei is that the majalis of Imam Hussein should not be majalis which are secular in nature. Secular meaning that you take it and you make it be something which is superficial. We want to make sure that we cover those issues that we need to cover. as Imam Khomeini said, that the majalis should be covering those current issues which are really a problem that we need to address. And the last point I want to mention, which is mentioned by Ustad Abbasi, he says that, and this is particularly for those people who are doing tabligh of the deen, that in the majalis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, you shouldn't be afraid to say what you have to say. Allah says in the Quran that when it comes to our prophets, وَمَا عَلَى الرَّسُولِ إِلَّا الْبَلَاغُ الْمُبِينُ, the prophet only has to do two things. Balagh, which is mubin. He has to convey the message and he has to do so in a clear way. These majalis are not about trying to wow the audience with the best voices and the best, you know, like themes that everyone is just happy with. Sometimes we have to cover those issues which are uncomfortable, sometimes that are repetitive, sometimes that may be a little more dry and theoretical. But the message needs to be conveyed, and this is the forum which it needs to be conveyed in. And the last, very last thing I'll mention is from Ayatollah Behjad, rahmatullahi alayhi. He says that, very interesting, he says that this was at the time of the imposed war. And he says that these tawassul and these majalis, you should know the importance of them. He says during the old times when people would be affected by bala, then in Najaf, he says that they would turn to these type of gatherings to get rid of that bala. For example, when there was a plague, they would have majalis, even in the bazaar, they would have majalis. Because they knew that when it comes time to get our du'as answered, when it comes time when we don't have anywhere else to go, then we have to go begging at the doorstep of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And he says that, where are we with respect to this? We have our own problems. We don't have any solution for them. Why don't we make use of, why don't we enter into that door of rahmah of Allah, which is tawassul to the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And so with that, we do tawassul to the Imam of our time, and we ask him to accept us as the true azadar of Imam Hussein alayhi salam wa sallallahu ala Muhammad wa alihi al-tahirin.
صلى الله عليك يا سيدي ويا مولاي يا رسول الله. صلى الله عليك وعلى آل بيتك الطيبين الطاهرين. أخاب من تمسك بكم وأمنا من لجأ إلى حصنكم. يا ليتنا كنا معكم فوز فوزا عظيما. شهر المحرم فاتك العذر أوجعت قلب الدين يا شهر. شهر المحرم فاتك العذر أوجعت قلب الدين يا شهر. ليبيض يومك بعد نازلة منها يكاد الدمع يحمر غشيات هلالك غاشية بالطف يكسف عنها البدر وابن فاطمة هي نهبت حشاو البيض والسمر يا حتى يضم عظامي القبر ومشرد أن ضاق الفضاء به فكأن لا بلد ولا أهم عليك يا أبا عبد الله The first night of Muharram Let's connect with Karbala Let's take our hearts to Abu Abdullah al-Hussein. Abu Abdullah arrived on the plains of Karbala. He asked his companions, "What is this land called?" Maybe he felt something when he arrived there. What is this land called? He said. Some said, Ya Aba Abdullah, they call it Nainawa. Some people said it's called Al Ghadriyatain. One of the companions came to Aba Abdullah and said, Ya Aba Abdullah, it is called Karbala. Aba Abdullah al-Hussein straight away said, A'udhu billahi min al-karb wal-bala. I seek refuge to Allah from calamity and hardship. What hardship you're going to see, Aba Abdullah? Women and the children come off the camels. Set up your tents here. This is our last stop. This is where we will be killed. محط رحالنا ها هنا تذبح رجالنا ها هنا تسبى نساؤنا صلى الله عليكم يا أهل بيت النبوة. Try to picture this. Imagine Zainab, Salamullahi alayha, hold my hand. Allow me to help you down from the camel. Ali al-Akbar is there to provide assistance. The children running around, not knowing where they are, what's going to happen to them. Sallallahu alaykum ya ahl bayt an-nubuwwah. Aba Abdullah is looking at them, seeing and saying to himself, there will come a time, O Zainab, you will want to leave Karbala, and you're looking around, where is Abulfadl? You're looking around, where's Ali al-Akbar? Where is Qasim? Instead of the men coming to help Zainab off the camel, Zainab has to go around helping the children and saying to the enemy, stop beating on the children. I will help them get on the camel. Imagine this scene in Karbala. Children, watch your uncle. I say, children, watch your uncle at this moment. There will come a day that will not even be able to find the body of Abu Abdullah. At this point, if you feel thirsty, you can call upon your uncle Abul Fadl. There will come a day when you would wish him to come back and say to him, just come back. We don't want any water anymore. ألا لعنة الله على القوم الظالمين وسيعلم الذين ظلموا أي منقلب ينقلبون والعاقبة للمتقين يا الله يا الله يا الله يا الله يا الله يا الله اللهم بحق مريض كربلاء زين العابدين شاف مرضى المؤمنين والمؤمنات اللهم شاف مرضى المؤمنين والمؤمنات وإلى أرواح المؤمنين والمؤمنات لا سيما الشهداء منهم رحم الله من يقرأ سورة الفاتحة تسبقها الصلوات.
Brothers and sisters, just a quick announcement. Inshallah, we'll carry on our normal schedule from tomorrow. We'll start at 7:45. It will start with Quran, then the Majlis, then the Masaib. And then following after that, we'll have Latmiya Noha by Brother Adil Kareem and Brother Nuruddin Al-Kadhimi. So it's just today that we had to finish it a bit early because of there's another program after this. So from tomorrow, inshallah, for the next night, 10 nights until Thursday, there will be majalis starting at 7:45. Aflaha man salla ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.